Early part of the 20th century, the fields of medicine and public health were very connected, and a schism developed between the two fields. And now medical training outside of a few institutions like Harvard, University of Miami, Einstein, does not include much training at all in public health. And we need to bring those two fields back together. And I think some of the examples Mark used, some of the writers that he spoke about, the theorists he spoke about, I'd like to see more of us reading that in medical school, nursing school, and even through the use of photography, getting communities involved, getting people to just look at the very moving photos of people like James Nakwe, a war photographer, Sebastio Salgado, who's documented some of the horrors that take place among workers in the developing world, Eugene Smith's photos of Minamata disease, and getting people to go back and read Chekhov and his writings on poverty, to read Dickens, and to really create more well-rounded physicians, nurses, and public health professionals. So I think providing that theoretical framework that you have provided and Veronique spoke about, I think, is very valuable. I'll just briefly give some background on myself. I'm a physician. I practice internal medicine part-time, and I teach public health, mostly social justice issues and medical humanities. And I also run a website called publichealthandsocialjustice.org. I'll put the information for that up at the end. It's an open access site that has PowerPoints, curricula, readings from literature, links to activist groups, and I do take submissions from students and from other faculty, and it's entirely free. There's no ads. I'd encourage you to log on and hopefully you get that resource. This particular talk, though, I became interested in when I wrote a piece on global warming, which resulted in a potential lawsuit against me and the publisher. So my opening disclosure is that I, until this year, wrote a regular column called Women's Health in Context for Medscape, for which I received a small payment for each article, which was a change from my usual writing. And while much of Medscape's content is supported by the pharmaceutical industry, my column was free of industry support and had no ads on it. I have no other funding sources despite my desire for them, nor conflicts of interest. But I don't think after you hear my talk today that anyone's going to fund me. So the background I'll speak about first is an article on global warming that I wrote. Then I'll talk about the organization came out to get me and Medscape. That's the American Council on Science and Health. A little bit about its history, its staff, and its funding. Then I'll talk about corporate front groups in general. I'll talk about ACSH and how it works through pseudoscience and misinformation, as well as attacks on scientists and the scientific enterprise, the implications of their activities for science and public health in general, and give some other examples of obfuscation of science by corporate interests, and then draw some conclusions and make some suggestions about how we can decrease corporate and industry influence over the dissemination of scientific information. So I wrote an essay on the health and environmental consequences of global warming for Medscape, in which I described the American Council on Science and Health as a corporate front group and criticized its selection of Michael Crichton, the author, as the recipient of its 2005 Sound Science Medal. Now, Crichton's book, State of Fear, questions the existence of human-caused global warming. Interestingly, as an aside, Crichton also received the American Association of Petroleum Geologists Journalism Award the same year. The leader of the American Council on Science and Health, Dr. Elizabeth Whelan, has referred to the belief that burning fossil fuels has caused global warming as pseudoscience, and she's criticized environmental scientists as doomsayers and fearmongers. When this piece first came out, the lawyers for ACSH contacted my editor at Medscape, as well as the attorneys at Medscape, and threatened a lawsuit if they kept the article up on the website. Medscape, in fact, briefly pulled the article, and it was offline for about 3 or 4 days. But to their credit, they reposted the article along with additional information that I'd written subsequent to that criticizing ACSH. Now, there was some potential loss of readership here, since most articles that are posted on Medscape are, in fact, read within the first few days of their posting. So the fact that this disappeared may have cost me some readership. So who is this leader? Dr. Elizabeth Whelan and Frederick Stare started the American Council on Science and Health in 1978. Whelan's early writing career included freelance writing for Pfizer criticizing the FDA, as well as some pieces for Harper's Bazaar and Glamour, and a book entitled Panic in the Pantry, as well as Toxic Terror. She makes quite a bit of money. The last, and I should say a lot of the dates for my slides are not necessarily recent, but through my investigative reporting, I'll put that in quotation marks, the information that I came up was the most recent that was available, and all of the quotes and all of the information I have regarding American Council on Science and Health come from their own website. So their own comments on various examples of science come from their website. Her 2003 salary was over $300,000. Gilbert Ross, who's another one of the leaders at ACSH, joined their staff as an assistant in 1997 and became coordinator of medical projects the following year, and then was appointed medical director and then finally executive director. Dr. Ross spent 1996 in a federal prison after being sentenced to 46 months for Medicaid fraud, perjury, obstruction of justice, but interestingly, he does not mention any of this on his bio on the ACSH website. He was actually barred by the Department of Health and Human Services for 10 years from participating in either Medicare or Medicaid. His career has included defending the Wood Preservative Science Council against health claims regarding arsenic in pressure-treated wood. He wrote on behalf of the farmed salmon industry that PCBs in fish do not cause any health problems, and he is now in charge of all scientific projects, publications, and personnel issues involving scientific staff at the ACSH. The ACSH Board of Directors has included a number of anti-regulatory individuals. This is from a 2001 survey by CorpWatch. And they have received over the years funding from right-wing foundations and corporations, as well as accepting money to write and disseminate pro-industry studies, again, in quotation marks. What are corporate front groups? Corporate front groups are groups that promote corporate agendas and ideology. They tend to have strong financial and advisory links with corporations, and they disseminate misinformation and even lies under the guise of science, which is non-peer-reviewed or, in many cases, simply cherry-picked or taken out of context. They tend to promote a pro-business and conservative ideology. So let's look at the history of ACSH and some of its pronouncements. They have attacked the precautionary principle as being anti-science and anti-technology phobia, fundamentally reactionary and elitist, there's that term, and more on the order of theology than science. They've minimized the effects of environmental tobacco smoke on human health, despite the fact that it contributes to at least 38,000 deaths per year in the United States. They have denied many of the adverse neurological effects of lead exposure, denied the endocrine disrupting effects of PCBs, and claimed that the court-ordered cleanup of the Hudson River by GE was based on false claims of PCBs causing cancer. They've also claimed uncertainty regarding the effects of agricultural antibiotics. And this is a typical tactic to say not enough is known, more study is needed. They have called warnings regarding tuna consumption by pregnant women an unfounded health scare, and have critiqued health concerns regarding trans fatty acids, saying there is no such thing as junk food, again, quotes from articles from their website, and there is insufficient evidence of a relationship between diet and any disease. They have claimed that irradiated food is safe, wholesome, and nutritious, and that no radioactive isotopes are involved, which is in fact not true. They have denied the link between dioxins and pesticides and adverse health effects, and have supported the use of human volunteers in pesticide toxicity studies, although none of their staff, to my knowledge, has actually expressed a willingness to volunteer themselves. What's the reality? We could go over each one of these claims and spend 15 minutes refuting them, but just as an example, the EPA has said that U.S. farm workers suffer up to 300,000 pesticide-related acute illnesses and injuries each year, and the National Academy of Sciences has said that pesticides in our food could cause up to 1 million cancers in the current generation of Americans. The World Health Organization has said that 1 million people have been killed by the effects of pesticides over the last 6 years. These are some things that the ACSH has called phony health scares: mercury in tuna and other fish, flame retardant traces found in blood and breast milk, PCBs in the Hudson, diesel exhaust fumes from school buses, arsenic in drinking water, phthalates in medical devices and children's toys. And I should just mention, as an aside, the issue of PCBs in the Hudson is quite important. GE is America's largest corporate polluter and was responsible for dumping PCBs in the Hudsons for many years. It should be noted that GE recently signed a technology sharing agreement with Columbia New York Presbyterian Hospital, in which the hospital system would buy all of its CT scanners and radiation therapy from GE for a period of 10 years. I wrote a piece that covered the broad topic of institutional ethics questioning this arrangement and finding some bit of irony in the fact that GE polluted the Hudson, causing the breast and other cancers in women who would then go to local New York hospitals and be diagnosed with GE CT scanners and treated with GE radiation therapy equipment. This ended up being published in one of the minor journals where I tend to get my stuff, a journal called Synthesis Regeneration. I tried submitting it to the New England Journal just as a letter to the editor after there was a large piece discussing the economics of this arrangement and no mention of the ethics nor of that irony, and they refused it. It may have been the quality of the writing, though. Why is this dangerous? First of all, ACSH doesn't just make pronouncements in isolation, and these are not just crazy people who have a website that gets no hits. We'll talk about their visibility in a moment. But some of the tactics they use are quite loathsome, and their litigation against Medscape is antithetical to the rules of science, which requires the free exchange of information and opinion in pursuit of the truth. They have also conducted ad hominem attacks, calling environmentalists toxic terrorists. Dr. Whelan criticized Dr. Barry Levy, who's a former president of this organization, as well as citizen activist Aaron Brockovich, as, quote, individuals who pursued self-serving financial opportunities through litigation. So just a little bit on Barry Levy, with whom I've worked in the past. He's an expert in asbestos-related litigation. He's the past president of this organization, as well as winner of the Sedgwick Medal, and his career has included work with the CDC, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the presidency of IPPNW. And Aaron Brockovich received the Harvard School of Public Health's highest honor, the Julius Richmond Award, and is well known for exposing PG&E's pollution of California groundwater with chromium-6, which is linked to stomach cancer. Now, ACSH has a very broad media presence, unfortunately. Their website attracts large numbers of individuals. In fact, they brag that in 2005 they got 100,000 hits per month. My site gets 4,000, and most activist groups get smaller amounts than this. Dr. Whelan has been featured on the Today Show, CNN Live, CNBC's Business Insiders, a number of other programs that I haven't listed here, and editorials by her and by Dr. Ross, the convicted felon we mentioned at the beginning, have appeared in the New York Times as well as in the Wall Street Journal. What are the implications of these attacks on science and scientists? Well, first off, they mislead the public and may actually cause alterations in lifestyle and/or purchasing habits, which could have adverse consequences to individuals' health. There are threats of litigation and slap suits or strategic lawsuits against private parties distract, intimidate, and deplete the scientific, legal, and financial resources of individuals and groups committed to public health. Their faulty pronouncements can influence elected officials, and their threats of litigation can divert the valuable time of healthcare providers, editors, and legal departments away from their more productive missions of teaching, research, writing, and patient care. In fact, some scientists and healthcare advocates may decide that it's wiser to avoid conflict than to publish content to which the American Council on Science and Health and other such groups might object. I'm going to take a little bit of segue just for a few moments to talk about the role of public education, the role of corporations in promoting an anti-science agenda, and then try to draw some conclusions from all of this. Unfortunately, in the United States, inadequate funding of science and health education means that individuals may lack the background necessary to recognize sound science versus ideological bunk. And because of depleted funds for public education, corporations have started to step in offering free curricula to public schools in areas such as environmental science to promote their own anti-science agenda. To understand environmental health issues, in fact, to understand most public health issues, you have to know a little bit of science. This was a questionnaire passed around by a seventh grader at the Iowa State Fair a few years back. I hope nobody's from Iowa, but I'm sure you would have gotten these results anywhere else. And he went to 100 people and asked them if they would sign a petition to ban dihydrogen monoxide. This is a chemical that can cause excessive sweating and vomiting. It's found in acid rain. It can cause severe burns in its gaseous state. It causes erosion, and it's been found in the tumors of terminal cancer patients. It sounds very dangerous. 93 of the 100 people he approached said, yes, I will sign your petition. We must ban this horrible chemical. 5 people said, get away from me, kid. I don't participate in surveys. And 2 people said, wait a second, that's water. Exactly. So there is a basic scientific ignorance in this country, unfortunately. There's also a geographic ignorance that's widespread. This was from a survey a few years ago looking at the percentage of U.S. teens who were unable to locate the following on the map. Almost 1 in 9 could not find their own country. Almost 1 in 3 couldn't find the Pacific Ocean. And then the numbers get even more pathetic. This is the percentage of Americans who believe to at least some degree in these phenomena, and you can see that there's been a rise in belief in pseudoscience. We are entering the age of the demon-haunted world. Astrology jumping from 17 to 37%, UFOs up to 30%, reincarnation and fortune-telling. And today, half of U.S. citizens do not believe in evolution and actually believe that humans and the dinosaurs coexisted. 37% of people believe that places can be haunted, and 1 in 4 believe in UFOs. 1 in 5 Americans don't know whether an atomic bomb has ever been dropped, and 1 in 5 don't know that the Earth, in fact, revolves around the sun. So who else steps in addition to corporations? Well, religion, with their scares and ideology. This is a headline from The Onion. Evangelical sciences refute gravity with their new intelligent falling theory. So as an example of what corporations can do, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over greenwash so that we have time for questions, and astroturfing and other corporate front groups. But just tell you briefly what their tactics are. They tend to invoke poor people as their beneficiaries and characterize their opposition as technophobic, anti-science, anti-progress, and they try to portray their products as environmentally beneficial despite the absence of evidence to that effect. I'll give you some examples of these corporate-sponsored environmental educational materials. Exxon has provided its Energy Cube to elementary and junior high schools. In this curriculum, you'll find statements like gasoline is simply solar power hidden in decayed matter, which is in fact true, but doesn't say much about the consequences of our dependence upon gasoline. Offshore drilling creates reefs for fish, again, true, but again, somewhat confuses and muddles the issue and ignores the consequences. And these are two of my favorites, the American Nuclear Society's activities with the Adams family for the junior high kids, and then Dow has Chemapalooza modeled on the Lollapalooza rock tour. We've also seen under the current administration an erosion of science, where appointments to key scientific bodies are based on corporate connections and political or religious ideology rather than scientific expertise, excessive corporate influence over legislation, and the rewriting and even suppression of scientific policy statements is just two examples. One was the suppression of the NASA Global Climate Change Report. that Dr. Hansen has spoke out about many times, and another is the appointment to the FDA's Reproductive Drugs Advisory Committee of David Hagar, who's an obstetrician who wrote the book As Jesus Cared for Women, in which he advises scripture reading as a treatment for PMS. So this is the type of science that we've seen under this administration, which fortunately is leaving, and hopefully the door will hit them on the way out. So, in conclusion, professional and lay publications should expose the workings of groups like the American Council on Science and Health, and scientists should fight back against this harassment, and we need to, in the broader terms, improve the quality of our public education and get corporations out of the classroom. These are the specific references, since you won't have time to look at these. The article that I ultimately published on ACSH made it into Z Magazine, which is a progressive journal that has a circulation of about 60,000, and hopefully was read by more than my mom and my wife. The global warming piece is on Medscape and also was reproduced in World Affairs Journal. But all of these you can find on my website, publichealthandsocialjustice.org or pshj.org. So what I'd like to do now is, since I had some extra time speaking, I'm going to open it up not just to questions to me, but to questions to all of us regarding the topics we've had today. And I know that there were a couple people who had specific questions for Mark. So why don't we, I believe you were one of them, ma'am, why don't we start with you and then open it up to the larger group. Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, my name is Rebecca Teacum and I'm from the University of Michigan. And so there's a couple of observations based on the talk, Mark, and also the discussion that followed. And after your last presentation, I hope you won't discount this, even though I do believe I lived in a haunted house once. So I wrote this down, so don't forget. But I think that while public health professionals and academics may struggle to see to understand the social ecological framework and do a structural analysis, I do believe it's crystal clear for community members, and they can very well articulate that. And also a couple observations I made on PPHA, a colleague who does consulting on public health programs and lives in Boston, but won't go beyond Park Street, South Station, or Back Bay. So this is the downtown area, never getting out to the community. But so more conversation between communities and public health professionals. And then I think the public health funding scheme is a huge problem to eliminate these. When you have a system of private and public funding streams that are dependent on probably focusing on a specific population, a specific disease, and then competing across different communities so that you kind of have this divide and conquer kind of structure set up. And my last observation was just to echo something you said, Mark, about focusing on community organizing and policy advocacy in the communities, because there is a lot of work going on right now, so we can find some way to create structures for connecting and supporting and funding that work. I think that would help. So,
Mark and Veronique, also feel free to open the questions to the entire panel. But we'll start with you, Mark.
I agree with everything you said. I think you're probably right about the class and structure type thing, where it's actually a product of certain types of education that destructuralize the world for everyone and depoliticize a lot of things. You know, just stemming from the separation from politics, from economics in the first place with neoclassical economics. That happens in everything where people don't talk about how political so many things are. And I guess from what I'm not a professor, but from what I've heard about professor funding or academic funding, I guess there are teacher grants. Maybe some of you guys know about this more than I do. There used to be teaching grants for professors, and then in the early 80s they got rid of them, so then the funding scheme shifted so that you had to get most of your funding through research grants, I guess, and so that really changes what people can actually be looking at. So, sorry, like, just directed that towards research or something. But I mean, the research is important too. So, yeah. Oh, wait, let her go first because I should. Sorry.
And sir, were you waiting at the microphone?
Yeah, I was.
We should let the gentleman go. Okay. Why don't you go first, ma'am, then you, sir, then you, ma'am. Can you tell us what you do?
My name is Maria Almeida, and I'm a student at UC Berkeley.
Okay. Do you have a comment on that?
I agree with you. I think we have to work all together. We are practitioners, theorists, researchers. For example, I am a researcher, and I like to promote a transdisciplinary framework to put forward some new recommendations for a new globalized public health, which means in reality a public health without borders, a new structure of public health. But I think we have to work together and to make advocacy to where we are from our local specific spaces.
Mark?
It's hard to say like that this field is our ally or that, you know, this discipline is our ally or something, because even within public health, you know, it's not like everyone is talking about the things we're talking about here, as you pointed out earlier. And so part of it is just navigating within your own communities to find people who know what you're talking about, and then also to talk when you are talking to people you meet to not be afraid to bring up some of these issues, because like a lot of the things we're talking about are like sort of like hush hush, you're not supposed to talk about these types of things, and so it really does take a certain amount of like personal risk in putting yourself out there. But oftentimes people are like, oh, that's really interesting, tell me more about that, maybe. I think also community groups tend to fragment, actually. Or people are more inclined to start a new community group or a new NGO or something rather than getting involved with an already existing one, because you know, there's so much like emphasis on being an entrepreneur and doing things your own way and being a pioneer and all this and that, that people don't want to get involved in what's already going on to try and strengthen that and put their own energy into something else that someone else has started, and maybe it's not exactly the way they want to do it. So I don't know, I guess that's one thing I would encourage, is instead of trying to start a new group, that we look for what's already out there. That's like.
And my comments on this would be that it starts at the local level. It starts with the PTAs, with the parents getting involved, finding out what their kids are learning, what textbooks they're using. Are there biology textbooks teaching evolution? Are they getting just abstinence-only education that we're funding to the tune of almost $200 million a year? Are they getting comprehensive sex ed? I would change the requirements for getting into medical school, that you had to have one course in public health and one course in ethics. I would encourage involvement in existing organizations, with the caveat that many of them are becoming corporatized, in a sense. The CEOs of some of these groups, like the Heifer Project, which I think does wonderful work, its CEO makes almost $250,000 a year. Is that necessary? the Gates Foundation, which you'll see a lot of praise for here, and I think the Gates Foundation has put its money in a lot of the right places, but unfortunately the LA Times earlier this year conducted an expose in which they found that the Gates Foundation was investing a lot of its money in corporations and in interests that were actually damaging human health, damaging the environment. And as just one example, they were heavily invested, about two-thirds ownership in a bunch of Nigerian oil wells. And in the very same community where there were huge rates of asthma, they were passing out free asthma inhalers. So why is it that foundations and NGOs have adopted an investment strategy and even a leadership structure that mimics the very corporate ideology that we're trying to overturn? So I think there's a number of ways in which you can change this, but certainly it has to start at the bottom of it. It has to start by interested parents who not only will question what their children are learning, but will offer, if they have the expertise and the degree, to go into the schools and to teach a session themselves if need be. Sir.
Great Pappas, Alcon University. First of all, thank you. Great session. Sorry, I may have missed something, even a little late. I wanted to ask Mark a very specific question. This un-American committee, or anti-American committee that you're describing, who funds them? And second is just a thought or comment. You might take a look at Peter Galbraith's recent book, Predator State, which talks about the way that corporations have not co-opted but totally dominated U.S. government in such a way that we don't think about it the way that we like to think about it as a democracy, but more like the way we think about places like Nigeria and Pakistan. So, you know, great book, and puts your work in a slightly different context. You might like to look at that. But anyway, did I miss something?
No, they currently do not disclose their funding. The last time they did was the early part of this decade, and it was on their website, and you can look on CorpWatch to see their actual funding, but much of it came from oil companies, pharmaceutical industry, others. Since 2003, I believe, they haven't said anything about it. But a lot of the startup money came, if I remember correctly, from the Olin Foundation, the Scape Foundation, a number of right-wing foundations. The actual fundings, if you look at my article on the website, you'll see the names of the groups that not only founded them but that supported them as of the last time they made such information available.
Yeah.
I was
going to
piggyback a little on what you said that probably the best way to achieve any kind of change, which is what we're talking about, is start at the grassroots level. And so everybody's got to start in their own community and advocate and open their mouths and write and talk and gather a few people together who are like minds and work with them. You know, I go back to Margaret Mead every time. You know, the only thing that really has ever changed the world is a small group of dedicated people who are willing to put themselves out there to do it. And I think that's the only thing that's going to work this time. Because what you're really up against, as far as I'm concerned, is the ignorance of the American people. And it's being deliberate. They're being deliberately kept ignorant. Okay, by the problems in the schools, by the trash you see on TV, the trash you hear on radio, the trash they watch on television. It's, you know, they're being, you know, you try to have a intellectual conversation with most of them, and all they really care about is who won American Idol. Okay, so what you're up against when you talk about theory or conceptualization of all this are people who have an inability to do that. Yeah. Okay, there's just a total inability to do that. And so when you talk to them, you have to talk to them in more black and white concrete terms. You have to make it personal. They have to understand that what this means to them personally, okay, and how it's really affecting them or their children or where they live in their environment, okay. We've got to get them away from worrying about where their next pair of Nikes are going to come from, to where they're clean, to talk about clean water, to talk about clean air, okay. What I'm really talking about is the marketing of science, the marketing of public health, the marketing of that, because we're up against the marketing
What do you do?
I'm the director of public health nursing. Okay, so that's what I do.
And Veronique or Mark, comments?
I appreciate your comment because I'm in a faculty of nursing to try to get the medical power. I'm a physician. I was a psychiatrist. Particularly, I appreciate your comment. I am in the Faculty of Nursing at Laval University because I'm fighting against the power, the medical power. Even I am a physician, I am a psychiatrist by training, but I think, yes, I have no comment, but I really appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Yeah, I just realized I'm the only one who didn't put up contact information, and so if anyone does feel like they want to contact me, my email address is healthispolitics@gmail.com. I think one issue is the amount of time people have. So if you're working like 60 hours a week or something, these low-wage jobs are so exhausting. Like you get so I did this for a long time. I did low-wage working for a long time, and when you get home, like you don't have the energy to be like, I'm gonna go read the news, and I'm gonna go for half an hour. I didn't even have children. Like I can't even imagine what it's like to have children and to be running a family and trying to make it like this. So that's a major issue, and maybe one way to work with that is to, have support groups so that, in your organization it's also like a form of support or something. I don't know if that's an idea, but I think what you said also about the power of groups is also, as an activist and someone who maybe feels a little bit excluded at times from certain discussions, you really do need to have other people you're working with just for your own spiritual energy or your ability to keep going. And I know in my own life, I haven't been doing this very long, but that's something that I know is probably the most important thing, to be in a community of people who are working towards the same things you're working towards. So and it's great to meet all you guys here.
Well, I'll thank you all for coming. I'll just conclude with a quote from Gunter Grass, the Nobel Prize winning author, who said the number one job of a citizen is to keep your mouth open. I'll get this back to my dad. Thank you, Baron.
Well, at least we're
yeah. Bye. Let's get the screen here. All right.
So nice meeting you, Baron. And best of luck. I'll look forward to seeing you. They look very complicated.
No, it's complex. Not complicated.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Johnny, do we have a crash cart up here for the projectors?
I can't remember offhand. I'm in room 5. I'll be with you.